Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the show, journalist David Daley will discuss how the Supreme Court's latest assault on the Voting Rights Act, together with relentless GOP gerrymandering efforts, could shape the midterms. We begin with a New York Times investigation that reveals how the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran is deepening the humanitarian catastrophe in Somalia, a country already pushed to the brink by drought, conflict, and Trump's devastating decision to dismantle USAID. According to today's guest, New York Times correspondent Peter Goodman, last year, the United States slashed humanitarian aid to Somalia from $467 million to just $70 million. In the first 4 months of this year, U.S. government donors contributed less than $3 million, only 2% of all relief aid going to Somalia. Countries like Britain, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Canada, and even Qatar are now contributing far more. Still, many European governments have also retreated, spurred by Trump's insistence that they spend more on the military and weapons rather than relying on American protection. Peter Goodman traveled to Somalia to report on the consequences of all of this and the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and the dismantling of humanitarian aid on millions of men, women, and children. He learned that the World Food Program warehouse normally holds emergency nutrient-rich pastes for children and pregnant and breastfeeding women. All but one was empty. After July, even those supplies will be exhausted. UNICEF has closed 205 of its 800 clinics in Somalia as it's lost funding. Peter Goodman writes, "In more than three decades of journalism, I have seen my share of tragedies, from the Indian Ocean tsunami to wars in Iraq and Cambodia. But what I saw and heard recently in Somalia shocked me." Peter Goodman is global economics correspondent for the New York Times and author of the books How the World Ran Out of Everything, Inside the Global Supply Chain, and Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for this important piece. And also, we want to thank your colleague, Finbar O'Reilly, for the very powerful images in this piece.
Thanks so much, Rose. It's really good to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you, Peter. You saw so much on this trip. You visited camps for displaced people, schools, health centers, a hospital for the treatment of malnourished children. And this trip was led by Mercy Corps. This is a U.S. aid group that runs relief and development programs around the globe. Can you tell us more about how this trip came together?
Yeah, so I was already focused on the impacts of the war in the Persian Gulf, you know, the U.S. and Israeli strikes in Iran and the retaliatory strikes from Iran throughout the Persian Gulf. I was looking at how it's not just oil that's choked up in the Strait of Hormuz, it's fertilizer as well. This may be a familiar dynamic to people who remember the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war. There was a similar effect with worries about malnutrition. And it was clear that there were lots of countries far beyond Somalia that were dependent upon the Persian Gulf for large volumes of fertilizer with the expectation that yields would get hit, food prices would go up. So I started sort of hunting around for a good place to tell that story. And then I spoke to Mercy Corps. I had worked with Mercy Corps previously. I traveled with them in Nigeria in 2023 for a look at the fertilizer crisis then. And they suggested that it would be possible to get to Somalia. Somalia is typically, you know, pretty dangerous. There's a lot of risk that goes in there. But they saw an opportunity. And I realized in talking to them that, you know, this story goes well beyond Somalia. We are looking at the first real grave test to what one Mercy Corps official described to me as the post-aid era. I mean, we have so dismantled the international humanitarian relief system that's led by the U.S. Cutting and dismantling USAID. But, you know, as you quite rightly note in the introduction, that's other governments in Berlin, in London, also cutting back. And so Somalia was a chance for me to see up close what it looks like when you have a bunch of overlapping crises playing out at a time when we just don't have the safety net that we have traditionally had.
And just for some context, Peter, Somalia is the easternmost country in continental Africa. It borders Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Kenya. The population is about 20 million people. The poverty rate is very high. And as you write in your piece, in recent decades, the country has suffered civil war, a famine. The drought there is just devastating. About 6.5 million people were suffering hunger at levels deemed an emergency. And that included almost 2 million children under five facing acute malnutrition. What else do we need to know about Somalia?
Well, we need to know that within those numbers, so, you know, 6.5 million severely malnourished people, or rather acutely malnourished people, that's as of February, according to the UN Food and Agricultural Organization. At the time that warning came out, this was before the impacts of the war in the Middle East, lifting fertilizer, lifting fuel prices. And since the cuts to the humanitarian relief system that began last year, the World Food Program has gone from having money to serve about 2 million people facing malnutrition down to about 300,000. And that money runs out at the end of June. And this is, again, at a time when roughly a third of the population is looking at malnutrition at levels deemed an emergency.
And this is devastating. You interviewed Hamid Nuru, the World Food Program Somalia director, who said, "There are different categories of starvation. We are only able to reach those who are really on the verge of it. If you don't give them something now, they will not be there tomorrow. In some areas, children are still getting food, but not pregnant mothers." He said, literally, I mean, this is so hard to read. It's who dies first and who dies next.
Right. Yeah, it's staggering. I mean, the thing that kept hitting me as I did this reporting, you know, I started off in this town of Dolo on the Ethiopian border. This is a place where for years, people from all over who have needed to leave something, drought, conflict, instability of all sorts, have gone knowing that international relief organizations were clustered there. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, USAID, European non-governmental organizations, the World Food Program. And, you know, I dropped in there with Mercy Corps and discovered that there were still loads and loads of people streaming into a bunch of displaced persons camps there. And they were horrified, these people, as they're arriving, to learn that the international relief organizations have largely abandoned the area and there are no services. There's just simply nothing left there. And what blew me away as I spent time there was the realization that this is actually one of the better off places in Somalia. I mean, in a very relative way, the international humanitarian organizations that are operative in Somalia are going through what they describe as a process of hyper prioritization. You know, they used to be active in 90 districts of Somalia. Now they're active in 21 districts. I mean, they can't just cut around the margins or across the board. They have to make hard decisions about which places are now going to get nothing. And so I was in a place that was full of desperate people who were fleeing drought and conflict. I talked to a family that had walked for 9 days, 140 miles, carrying a three-year-old daughter on their shoulders, reaching this camp because their entire herd of cattle had succumbed to drought. That's their life savings wiped out. They had nothing to eat. The rivers had been depleted. And this constitutes a place deemed better off than the 21 districts of the 90 that are still getting money, such that this town, Dolo, did not make the cut.
Peter, there are so many dots that you connect here. When we do shows about the climate crisis, we talk about places like Somalia that are really doing the least to cause the climate crisis, and yet they're being hit so hard.
Right.
So you start your piece, as you say, focusing on this family who have been hit very hard by the climate crisis. They're losing their animals because of this. And then they're walking 9 days, 140 miles with a three-year-old and other children, thinking that they're going to get help. But because of cuts to USAID, which happened in the United States because of Trump and Elon Musk, they find nothing. So then what?
Well, they're stuck. I mean, they can't, there's no place to go back to. The land will not support agriculture at the moment. There is conflict in the area. So they're hunkered down. I mean, as I was spending time with this family, you know, first of all, in a neighboring tent, I met a woman who's lost four children in recent years to various ailments. And she was holding in her arms her two-day-old baby. He had come into the world in the midst of this chaos. She, once she went into labor, had been taken by her sisters to a health clinic set up inside this camp. The clinic had previously been funded by UNICEF. UNICEF does get a lot of money, or has traditionally, from the U.S. government. They'd had to close health centers, including this one. So they get there, she's in labor, and there's a lock on the door. So she had to beg in this state to get the fare to hire a tuk-tuk, a motorized rickshaw, to take her 30 plus minutes to a hospital in a neighboring town. The fare itself had doubled because diesel prices are up, gasoline prices are up. And she's lying in the back of this motorized rickshaw in labor, in real pain, going over these bumpy dirt roads to get to the hospital. Meanwhile, the family that I'm focused on that has walked the 140 miles to get to this camp, the mom is walking over a bridge into Ethiopia, trying to get jobs, doing laundry, doing just basic household tasks for families that can afford her, though a lot of those families can't afford her services anymore because food prices have doubled in Ethiopia as well, in large part because of the shock to the transportation system. I mean, Ethiopia imports a lot of food as well, and fuel prices are up there as they are around the world. And the dad was going off to do farm labor jobs where he was making a dollar a day. I mean, they were subsisting on a daily meal. I mean, they weren't sure when they were next going to eat. They had been eating about once a day for the last few weeks, sorghum porridge, and then they were gathering up these weeds from the nearby riverbanks. Mm. And as long as they'd had some recent rain despite the drought, without rain, they won't even have those weeds. I mean, truly a hand-to-mouth existence.
And the dad, who's 47, said, "Milk and meat are just a dream for us. The children are hungry. It hurts." And Peter, this is another important dot that you connect, talking about how the closing of the Strait of Hormuz is affecting the food prices in these areas that are already dealing with a humanitarian catastrophe. You report that in Somalia, which depends on imports for 70% of its food, staple goods like rice and wheat flour doubled in price.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Somalia imports about 70% of its food. That's a lot. It's pastoral largely, and the drought has made it hard to grow even what crops can be grown there. But then there are all sorts of ways in which you've got the available agricultural land now putting out less because fertilizers come through the Strait of Hormuz as well, and fertilizer prices are up dramatically. And then the thing that really struck me was how these crises are now overlapping, and it's sort of a feedback loop of crisis. So the humanitarian relief cuts happened before the war, but the impacts of the war are now deepening the effect of the humanitarian relief cuts. So I'll give you an example. You know, UNICEF is trucking water to parts of Somalia that are afflicted by drought. Well, diesel prices are up, so it costs more to truck. Their budget is going down, not up, so they're now trucking less water. There are lots of wells. I visited some around these displaced persons camps in Dolo that are fueled by, the pumps rather, are fueled by diesel. So those prices are going up. So now you have people who are already hungry, who don't have a source of livelihood, and they're having to pay more for what water they get from the wells. And the real bitter irony of this is, you know, I'm traveling with this American aid group, Mercy Corps. They used to have programs in Somalia putting in solar cells at these wells, precisely so that people would not have their drinking water dependent upon this petroleum product that comes out of the Strait of Hormuz. And USAID has cut their funding, so they're not putting solar cells in anymore. So if you're exposed to the price of diesel, you know, there it is. Meanwhile, I talked to, I was glad that you mentioned this quote from Sheldon Yett, who is the UNICEF country director in Sudan. Sudan is, your listeners probably know, a scene of what's considered the most dire humanitarian crisis in the world at the moment. I mean, there are parts of Sudan that are officially under famine. And Sheldon's sitting on stocks of food that he's managed to get into the port of Sudan. Now, there are huge delays in the whole global supply chain for food aid because you have massive floating traffic jams off of ports in Oman, given the shutdown to marine traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. And he can't get the stuff that he's got on the docks into the worst hit areas of Sudan, because not only are diesel prices up, which makes trucking more expensive, but at any price, trucking companies will not carry this cargo because they're worried about actual physical shortages of diesel in the hinterland, and they're worried that their trucks will get stuck there. So these are the ways in which, again, these two crises are now making all parts worse. Mm.
Today, we are speaking with Peter Goodman, global economics correspondent for The New York Times. Peter recently traveled to Somalia to report on the consequences of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, and the dismantling of humanitarian aid, and Trump's decision to shut down USAID on millions of men, women, and children in Somalia and other countries, because this is not just, obviously, it's just not happening in Somalia. If you have any questions for Peter about what he saw and where this is going, how much longer can this last? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Peter, how did people respond to you, knowing that you are from the United States, the country that has dismantled the USAID?
Well, I mean, the ordinary people that I encountered, I mean, particularly people in these camps, were just glad that some white person was there, you know, indicating someone from far away, showing some concern. And I certainly felt, I mean, I'm always careful on that sort of reporting to not come off as like the latest white guy come to fix all of Africa's problems. And I'm very careful to not make people promises I can't keep. But I think just a showing of concern, you know, was appreciated. What I was really struck by, though, was my first day in Dolo, we were taken to go meet the deputy mayor. And this, you know, I thought of as a sort of ceremonial thing just to get permission to go and report in that area. And we were sitting down underneath this really handsome mango tree on the riverbanks. This is the border, this river separating Somalia from neighboring Ethiopia. And the deputy mayor, completely unprompted, said, "Oh, you know, you're American. What's going on with your government? You know, why are we being treated this way?" And I said, "I'm definitely interested in hearing your perspective. Tell me more." And he said, you know, similar to the point that you were making earlier, he said, "You know, look, Somalia, we are responsible for fewer industrial emissions than just about any country on Earth. It's wealthy countries, it's large economies that are responsible for climate change, and yet we're being punished, and now we have no say over this war. It has nothing to do with us, and yet, again, we're being punished." And then he said, "The situation has become unbearable. The American regime, that was the word he used, the American regime is led by a person who really doesn't care about anything happening outside his gates. The Americans are not honoring their commitment to the world. This was not in response to my sort of asking his opinion about Donald Trump. This was just my sitting down in a plastic chair opposite him and him engaging me.
Well, we have a question from a listener who says, USAID is so incredibly important. How much did we pay for it? And according to the Institute for Policy Studies, Peter, the average taxpayer paid about $36, $40 a year to fund USAID.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point because overseas aid has been so politicized in our country. There are so many things that need to be said. One is that this international relief system dates back to the Second World War and the Marshall Plan in Europe. So while there's this tendency to dismiss these sorts of programs that have been cut as just sort of charity, this has been, you know, an instrument of American trade and national security policy going back to the end of the Second World War. And some of this is compassion, and some of it is about, you know, we understand that failed states are sources of all sorts of elements that we are not interested in having to deal with, whether they're military threats, terrorism. We like the idea that people around the world are wealthy enough to be able to afford American manufactured goods and services. Again, going back to Europe. But, you know, we're in this moment where we're having lots of important debates about should we have, you know, taxes on billionaires? Should we have wealth taxes? And these are important debates, and I'm in no way dismissing them. I've actually been a participant in these debates. But that's not applicable here. You know, Jeff Bezos can keep his enormous fortune. Elon Musk can keep blasting people into space. We don't need to get hung up on this debate. In fact, middle-class people really don't have to sacrifice in order to maintain, or at this point it would be trying to resurrect, the international relief system that we've all taken for granted for all of our lives. I mean, you're talking about, I keep thinking about, you know, the scraps you take out of your sink filter at the end of the day after you've washed your dishes. Like, that's the sort of cost that we're talking about to ordinary people to address very, very acute and profound problems for the people on the receiving end of this aid.
We did a show about how our taxpayer dollars are being spent on tax day, and about 4,000 of our dollars goes to weapons and war. $40 was going to USAID for context. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Dell in Oakland. Hi, Dell. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I love your show. Listen to it every morning.
Thank you.
I have a question. So food's not getting in, but I also heard that weapons are not getting in. And I also heard that that was helping, you know, helping the people not deal with the war. Now, what does that say about where the weapons are coming from? And is it true that there's less strife going on because the weapons aren't coming in?
Thank you. Do you know, Peter?
Yeah, this is not something I dug into at all. And to be honest, it's not something that I heard about while I was on the ground in Somalia. Okay. I mean, the security situation seemed to be slightly better in the places that I was traveling. But, you know, security is not all about foreign journalists wandering around. There's certainly serious threat of conflict in Somalia, in Sudan. It's an interesting question you're asking. I'm in over my head.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question. Maybe we can do a show about this, Dell. Peter, before we let you go, you come at this from a really interesting perspective because we had you on the show a couple times talking about your book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. You write a lot about billionaires and inequality. Billionaire wealth is surging to unprecedented levels. I mean, it's, you can't even wrap your head right now around how obscenely wealthy people are. I mean, Elon Musk is, he's either a trillionaire or he's going to be a trillionaire. And he's the one who was in charge of Doge. This is one of the first things that this administration did, is dismantle USAID. And it's, on the one hand, you can almost kind of understand, okay, people want more and more and more money. But what I don't understand is the cruelty as a result of things like shutting down USAID. What are your thoughts about this, given your background and that you write books about these issues?
I mean, I think that there is, in our own political narrative, so much currency now to this idea that anybody who needs help anywhere on earth is a loser, is someone who hasn't tried hard enough. And that idea did not gain currency by accident. You know, it was the result of a carefully orchestrated over decades campaign by the beneficiaries of inequality, the people with most of the wealth in our country, who used it as a prophylactic against taxation and regulation. I mean, this was the thesis of my book, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Mm-hmm. And they have very effectively managed to protect themselves from things like wealth taxes. But now, under Trump, too, they've really gone on offense, actually dismantling parts of government that are critical, with this idea that anybody who needs government services in the United States or anybody who needs American aid overseas is, you know, it's back to the old welfare queen trope that we remember from the Reagan days, only it's much more extreme. This idea that you just haven't worked hard enough if you have any problems. And that's a poisonous idea, because, of course, government comes out of the understanding that there are problems that are best addressed at the societal level and that all of us could need help at one point or another. I mean, this is how modern insurance works. This is just the very notion of community. And so in some ways, in many ways, you could argue that taking apart USAID and the U.S. renouncing its post-World War II commitments to the international order represent the logical extension of these sorts of thoughts that were set in motion as a way to protect the very wealthiest people from having to pay anything.
Mm. And yet, I mean, when you look at weapons and war, this is just really pennies compared to what's spent there. And you also have to wonder, Peter, how long this can last before people rise up and revolt. Because when you have to feed your children, I mean, you'll do anything to make sure your kids are fed. Before we let you go, when you were talking to people on the ground who do this important work day after day, what did they say about how long it's going to take to rebuild these systems?
Well, I mean, aid workers are heartbroken. But I mean, the thing that hit me in talking to these international relief organizations is that, you know, USAID is an institution about which there have been vigorous debates, you know, about aid dependence, about ideological bias, about whether the U.S. is pursuing its own interests while pretending to try to rescue the world. I mean, there's lots of sort of critiques you can engage in about the mode of USAID. But give this institution its due. It was full of people who were expert and viewed as expert by their peers around the world at quickly mobilizing tremendous support in moments of crisis. You know, people who are expert in epidemiology, people who are expert in procurement, in quickly erecting emergency shelter, in getting aid to where it was needed in real time. And that's not something that you can rebuild quickly. It took decades to build that capacity. And even if we restored the funds right now, I mean, USAID was an institution that had thousands of employees. It's now got 86 people basically just trying to close out accounts and deal with legal challenges over potentially illegal firings. You're not going to put this thing back together by just flipping a switch. Sorry for the mixed metaphor.
No, it's a it's a devastating story and one that deserves so much more attention. Peter Goodman is global economics correspondent for the New York Times. He recently traveled to Somalia to report on the consequences of the Trump administration shutting down USAID and the consequences of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran and the closing of the Strait of Hormuz. Peter Goodman was on the show to talk about his latest books, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain, and Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Peter, thank you so much to you and your colleagues for this important report. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose. I really appreciate you putting the spotlight on this.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk with independent journalist David Daley about the Supreme Court's recent decision to further gut the Voting Rights Act and what this will mean for the midterms and beyond. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.